Welcome along to Top Shelf Tech. Today we have Dr. Ken Uchart from Zscaler joining us again. We're very fortunate to have Ken back with us. And the topic we're going to discuss today is all around quantum computing. And as a, I guess, just way of an introduction, last time we had Ken on, we were talking about 5G and security. And when we turned off the cameras and we stopped recording, Ken and I had a chat backstage and we got onto the topic of quantum computing, as Ken mentioned that he'd been going to lots of, seen lots of vendors starting to tout quantum computing and how nobody was really kind of getting it right, doing justice. And then I think we talked for about 10 minutes where you went on to blow my mind in all sorts of various ways around things that I just couldn't fathom. And I thought, well, we should give our guests, our audience, the same experience. So Ken, welcome back.
Thank you.
And
good to be here again.
And yeah, awesome. And today I'm going to hand over to you because I really don't even know where to start on this topic. And maybe we start where we started and just discuss quantum computing. It's being touted by vendors now. There's lots of sort of, you know, I guess the ramp up of the sales engines we've seen. But if we start there, what is it? What are we missing? And where to from there?
Yeah, I'm going to start with apologies to Sir Winston Churchill, but honest to goodness, never have so many people talked so much about a subject they know so little of. You know, I know it sounds funny, but it, honest to God, I'm hearing all these things by people who just don't have the background and don't really understand what's going on, because if they did, they'd make a couple of observations, which is people who've been in quantum theory for their entire lives, the older they get, they basically say things like Richard Feynman did, which is, if you think you understand quantum theory, you don't understand quantum theory. It's not something you pick up overnight. It's not something you pick up in a course. And all, you know, I've gone and looked up, I looked up the definition of quantum computing online. I said, what's quantum computing to Dr. Google? Dr. Google came back with, quantum computing is what? A multidisciplinary field comprising aspects of computer science, physics, and mathematics that utilizes quantum mechanics to solve complex problems faster than on classical computers. The field of quantum computing includes hardware research, application development, and some other stuff I can't remember. What does that say to you? What do you take away from that definition?
Well, I'd take away from it that it's not really a definition. It doesn't feel like a definition to me. And probably where I was kind of trying to get my head around quantum is almost felt that you're trying to think in a linear step from what we know today about computing into just the next generation, which, you know, could go a bit faster and be a bit different in terms of how it processes stuff. But I think the more we talk, the more I figured out, it's just so fundamentally different. There's not a logical, I struggle to find a logical step from where we are today and what we understand about computers mm-hmm. into this yeah. next world. And so those statements just feel like big, meaningless statements.
Well, it's like saying, hey, cars are amazing. They drive down the street. They accelerate. They brake. You put gas in them. They're designed by smart people. Like, great. How does a car work? And then someone says, well, there's this thing called the Stirling cycle in thermodynamics that explain how an engine turns chemical, like a gasoline, into energy, which drives you forward. And again, you're still going like, yeah, okay, sure. And the other one is, we don't just have quantum computing. We actually have three kinds of quantum computing, four, if you include classical computers, like we're all familiar with, because they don't exist without quantum behaviors. And we have, you know, this type of computer called a quantum annealer. And you'll see that from companies like D-Wave. It's a very specific kind of machine. What it's doing is solving complex problems, finding the best answer by minimizing some kind of complicated function over many variables. This has really big applications in a lot of fields. That's available today. Then we have quantum analog machines. They are models of some complex system that leverages aspects of quantum mechanics to try to solve a harder problem that you're thinking is going to kind of be like it. So to understand one system, you build another one that kind of behaves like it. And then there's universal quantum computing, which is what people are chasing right now, just like there was universal classical computers, where a universal classical computer is, it's capable of solving any problem you can represent as an organized set of logical operations. Basically, it can execute a program. And as far, you know, and as recently as something like the late 1970s, we still weren't entirely capable of we hadn't quite understood what a classical universal computer was. A universal quantum computer is, well, we got this qubit manipulating machine capable of solving any problem we can express as an organized set of logical quantum operations. Again, sounds great. Well, what does it mean? Honestly, to understand what quantum computing is, there's this really simple and really disappointing explanation, which is you need a lot of math and physics. You basically need a physics background, at least a minor, if not a major, in mathematics. And yet in physics, you don't really come across what I call the beginnings of hardcore quantum mechanics until your third year. And even then, research into how we educate said that it's quite possible we don't give a firm enough grounding in the math until graduate school. You know, so when you say things like, oh, yeah, you want to understand qubits, we express them in Dirac notation, we got this quantum entanglement. Oh, and did I mention that it depends on Hilbert spaces? You know, well, what's a Hilbert space? Oh, that's one where you have a distance function. It forms a complete metric space, unless you can have a complete inner product space. And already we're lost. How can we have a conversation here unless you've come along with 4, 8, 12 years? Since the late 70s, there's still some things I'll sit there to this day and go, oh, wow, that's what I think it really meant. And, you know, we've been thinking about this for what, the day, 92, 93 years? And a lot of it's virtually unapproachable without a physics graduate degree, lots of math, and experience working, I would say, in the quantum realm.
So if I come back to I'm still of that era where you learnt things at school and your kind of early computer science type things around Boolean, around transistors, and that fundamentals of what we're doing today with computers, you know, the classical computer, it's all built around those kind of principles. And yeah, we've been, you know, able to build more and more transistors into chipsets, and we've been able to lower the latency for how they switch and whatnot to kind of expand what we, you know, build on very early, you know, vacuum tube based computers. Mm-hmm. How fundamental does any of that logic, does any of that still apply to quantum computing, or are you throwing all that out the window and it's fundamentally different?
No, it's like it and not like it. And the thing, remember, we're talking about wanting to build, we haven't even got to where, why do we want to do this? When you want to build what's called a universal quantum computer, we are taking a similar approach, except you have a lot more degrees of freedom. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, when you have a classical computer, you say, well, there's bits. You say, okay, I get this. All right, a bit is either a 0 or a 1.
Yep.
There's either no voltage or there's some voltage across something. And you go, all right, so it's either it's on or it's off. It's true or false. It's yes or no. Kind of definite. Quantum mechanics, you know, when you say, can I tell where all the electrons are precisely around an atom as they're zooming around? The answer is nope. We're not good enough for that. We can tell you probably where they're most likely to be found. We can compute statistically where we're probably going to find it 90 to 95% of the time. And even though that takes a huge amount of computing effort.
So is this, tell me if it's totally wrong. Is this, you know, the ones and zeros, the true or false? This is the, and I'm going to pronounce this terribly, Schrodinger's cat.
His cat, baby, my favorite subject. Is it alive or is it dead?
Yeah, is it a one, is it zero, or is it?
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. This is a fun thing about quantum mechanics. Mm. So let's say we're just talking about a qubit. A qubit, you'll see things like they'll draw a little sphere and they'll show an arrow and say, well, a qubit can take on any value between 0 and 1. this is a fun thing about quantum mechanics. Until you measure it, you don't know what state it's in. Mm. Meaning, I say, here's a qubit. You go, great. Is it a zero or one? You say, depends. Zero-ish, one-ish, could be-ish. You say, well, how do I tell? You measure it. What happened? Well, when you measure it, it's either going to be a zero or a one. But until you measure it, it could be either. And you go, wow, why is that? Well, in a subatomic world, we deal with probabilities. And until you look at it, the idea was you don't know what its state is. Now, why is that a smart thing in quantum mechanics or quantum computing? Well, when you got bits, you can go zero and you can go one. Wonderful. So if I want to represent increasingly complex things, I keep tacking bits on. And you say, well, okay, I want to simulate a real simple thing. I want to simulate a hydrogen atom, and I want to know where all the proton, the neutron, the electron, I want to know everything they're doing. And you go, fine. You go, and then I want to do, oh, I don't know, an oxygen atom or a carbon atom where there's, you know, eight electrons. And you go, okay. Here's the thing. When you want to simulate some number of particles in a quantum system using equations that we have for quantum motion, you need some for every particle. And if you have five particles, you need a bunch of numbers to express where it is, what it's doing, its speed, its velocity. And it turns out that you kind of need, for n particles, you need n to the power of n numbers to represent them. So simple thing like two particles, two to the power of two, four numbers. Four particles, four things in the quantum realm. Four to the power of four. I need 256 numbers. Yeah, fine. Let's double that. Eight particles. Okay, eight to the power of eight. 16,777,216. I haven't memorized. I'm not that smart. Numbers. And you go, eight particles? 16, nearly 17 million numbers? Yeah. How about if I double it again? Ooh, 16 particles. Yeah, it's not even enough to describe fairly simple atoms and molecules. That's 18 quintillion particles. And you go, what's a quintillion? It's a one with 18 zeros after it. In scientific notation, it's 1.8 times 10 to the power of 19. And you say, wow, that sounds like a lot. He's like, yeah, okay. Let's think about this. If I wrote each number, and you know, they're big numbers because you want accuracy. So if I wrote each number by hand on a piece of paper, just one number to one piece of paper. Paper is about what, 10th of a millimeter thick. So you can, every meter's worth, a stack of paper a meter tall, 10,000 numbers. Cool. So what's 18 quintillion numbers expressed as sheets of paper, one number per sheet? Try 4.7 million times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. That's how tall your stack is. That's hard to visualize. Let's along Earth to Jupiter. How many times? That's 2,325 times the distance from Earth to Jupiter. Still too big? How about 304 times the distance from the Sun to Pluto? Still kind of mind-boggling? 7.5 times the distance from Earth to Voyager 1, which is the farthest man-made object from the Earth today. And that's to describe a quantum system at one instant in time. You want to say, how does it change in the next tiny little instant? You got to compute all those numbers again. We do not have enough computing power in the entire Earth available to us to model 16 quantum particles. So this is why you don't get quantum computers simulated using a classical computer. And people can say, well, I've sort of done it. I can show you something like it. We can kind of simulate one or two or four qubits. Yeah, you can. Can you do anything interesting with it? Well, you can prove out some aspects of quantum computing. Cool. Can I do anything useful with it? Yeah. You know.
So in very simple terms for me, is that to say?
I know. It's really hard to think about these things, like numbers involved. They're outrageous.
It hurts my head. We're saying basically bits because you have to stack them and stack them to get anything useful. In a qubit, because you can observe the state and the state can be highly variable,
There you go. That's the secret.
More in a very much smaller amount of bits. And those bits have changed from bits as we know them traditionally to qubits.
Right.
But then there's something else that you mentioned last time with qubits that I still haven't totally got my head around. They can evaporate.
That's when you try to build a quantum computer.
Okay.
So I want things that qubits are kind of like, I can measure them as one or zero when I'm done doing some computation. The trouble, you need a particle that has a zero or a one, an A state, B state, true state, false state. And so you do things like an electron, which has these two states called up or down spin. Or you have a photon, a particle of light, which can have two polarization states. So you want something like that to start with. And then you say, okay, I bet to build a qubit, I got to put it somewhere. You know, in a computer, you get a little circuit and you know that electrical signal's in there and it can be zero or one. And it'll be kind of long-lived. You know, if you sit there and you just read the CPU and you say, well, what's in the CPU? What's the number sitting in the CPUs? Remember, we used to call them accumulators. Don't call them that. No. You read a number out and it gives you the number. Then you wait a little while and you say, oh, what is it now? It's the same number. No matter how many times you read it, no matter how much time you wait, provided the computer has power, that number's not changing. When you have a bunch of qubits together, you trap these little particles that have two states. And you usually do it using some force, some low dimensional structure. It doesn't have to stay there. There's this really interesting thing called quantum tunneling and evaporation, where particles can disappear. Particles that you've trapped carefully inside this delightful mechanism so you can use them as qubits. They can do something called tunneling out, where they'll just zip away on you. And that's what we call noisy. So if you want to have what's called a stable qubit, you typically have to have a whole bunch of qubits and some kind of error correction. So that if you do a calculation and some disappear, it's like you have a 32-bit computer and at the end of it, someone says, geez, that's only a 31-bit computer.
Almost like even a CRC check. So you're building
one of the bits disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, or you can say error correction like we used to do in CDs with music, because you couldn't always get all the little bits properly registered and some had errors, and you do some stuff to correct that so you wouldn't notice that there were some misprintings on the music track. So you can get around it, but you need quite a few noisy qubits to get a stable qubit. And getting back, we'll talk about that more in a second, but to get back to, you said, well, why are we interested in quantum computers? It's because the qubit doesn't have to have just one state, just a state zero or a state one, a state on, a state off. It can have any state in between it until you read it. Why is that useful? Well, if you stick two qubits together, remember, you stick two bits together, you get two bits. You can represent, zero to three.
Yep.
Fantastic. When you put two qubits together, you don't just get two bits. You can have four different states. And those states are formed out of complex numbers. You can think of complex numbers as actually two numbers in one that obey certain mathematical rules. So you end up with more numbers to play with. With two bits, you get four things to play with. Four bits, you get 16 distinct states you can play with during computation, but when you read them out, you're going to get four qubits. So in general, if you had n qubits, you can get 2^n states. Why is that important? If I have 64 qubits, well, guess what? I have that number again, 18 quintillion states I can play with. So I can do a whole bunch of tests simultaneously in a quantum calculation. And it's going to select the most probable result and they come back to, well, why are we scared about quantum decryption? Because you can take a quantum computer, a universal quantum computer, and you can do something like factor a number into two prime numbers quickly. Why is that important? One of the basis of one of our most popular forms of encryption is to take two huge prime numbers, and a prime number is something divisible only by itself, and one, you know, 7 is a prime number. 8 is not, because you can break it down into 2 and 4, but 7, you can do 1 and you can do 7. Think of really big prime numbers, and then you multiply them together to get an even bigger number. And you stick that into an algorithm and you'll get the ability to encrypt data. And then because you know the two prime numbers you multiplied together, at the other end, only you can decrypt them, because figuring out factorization of huge numbers that are two huge prime numbers multiplied together takes kind of the age of the universe of classical computing. Quantum computing, theoretically, there's a thing called Shor's algorithm, which will let you peel those apart much faster than the age of the universe. Now, it's not that easy, but you know, it's things like what? Let's say you have 128-bit encryption. 128-bit. Let's see. We take it. I think if you want to use a quantum computer to factor a number that's 2048 bits, two big prime numbers multiplied together, it's going to take you around 10,000 qubits, 2 trillion quantum gates, and a quantum circuit depth of 1.8 trillion. That's probably achievable in a few years, and it would take about 140 days. So it's not the age of the universe, but it's kind of 140 days, and we're not there yet, maybe 10 years off. Doing more complex encryption, and you can do more complex encryption algorithms. One thing we call asymmetric encryption algorithms, like you get today with, you know, I think RSA.
Is it RSA?
RSA. Those are the ones that'll get cracked first. But you have to ask yourself, if it's going to be how many years from now, how important is that data to me? Because, you know, credit card companies today, they actually say there's this sort of average rule is, if I can keep the credit card transaction data safe for 5 years, it's irrelevant. So someone lifts credit data today and says, I'll decrypt it later with quantum computing, probably not going to be much help. And so right now, if you've got a secret that can stay a secret for 50 years, and after that, no one really cares, you're probably safe from quantum decryption at course and speed. Even more so if it's a symmetric encryption algorithm, because those are not really amenable to quantum decryption. This is why we say there's this other train of thought called post-quantum cryptography. A classical algorithm, something you can do on a computer today, that is, we kind of think is very difficult to crack using a quantum computer. And we've already identified a number of algorithms like that, which kind of assumes we understand what a universal quantum computer is, and we're still kind of finding our way for this. But the thing is, with quantum computing, you get a lot more bits and states to play with. You get a way of trying a whole lot of things quickly. And because it's a statistical approach, you design the algorithm so that it's trying a whole bunch of combinations of numbers in a complicated system, and you want to find the best numbers. Like, I want to find the best chance that the qubits come out with the two large prime integers, and I need you to break that algorithm. It's very early days with this.
So if we then come right back to where we started the conversation, which is people trying to sell quantum computers, or, you know, marketing them, whatever it is. You mentioned one, I guess, use case, which is around encryption and decryption. Mm-hmm. What are the foreseeable use cases for quantum computing that are sort of driving people to start messaging to the market to say, hey, come buy ours. This is what you can do.
Well, remember, there's this kind of inside joke today, which is, what are quantum computing companies really doing? Is they're making money explaining to customers how good quantum computing is going to be when they finally get it, because they're not able to really deliver it today. They can deliver systems like, anybody can go to an IBM website and you can write quantum algorithms that execute on a 5-quantum-bit computer, which means you can take something kind of like Shor's algorithm, you can program it, and it will do things like factor up to 5-bit integers where you've taken 2 prime numbers and multiplied them together. And I believe, was there something with that one you can demonstrate factoring 21 into 3 and 7? It's great if you're trying to learn Shor's algorithm from a quantum perspective.
Yeah.
But being able to factor 21 into 3 and 7 is a proof of concept. It's not going to help you decrypt anything today. But it's there. And I think, you know, the record today, we've got something like 433 qubits. And they're pushing to exceed 1,000 and then 4,000 in the next couple of years. But, you know, as I said, Fujitsu, I believe Fujitsu engineers published a paper where they said, you want, remember I said to factor a 2048-bit key would require like, what, 10,000 qubits, 2 trillion quantum gates, circuit depth of nearly 2 trillion, and it still take about 140 days if they got there, and they're not there yet.
So our 5-qubit IBM computer is miles off even.
Well, it's again, if you want to learn something about quantum programming, it's there today. Do you have to, well, the thing is, do you have to understand a classical computer? Do you need to know about NOT gates? Do you need to know about how to create circuits by putting together a bunch of different logical operations? The stuff we used to teach in computer science, which isn't really emphasized anymore. You know, you don't really understand how to put a computer together logically. You may find out, you may have someone explain to you what a Turing universal computer is, and maybe teach you how to program one in an early computer science course, but that's about it. Yeah, you don't have to. It's like, do you need to know how a car's engine works to drive a car? The answer is no. You just need good muscle and hand-eye coordination.
So the more useful thing today is not trying to understand necessarily how you build a quantum computer. It's actually, like with that IBM 5-qubit example, actually, I guess in the same way that quantum computing works, it's around observability. So don't try to learn the logic. Try to actually observe how you would program it to learn from
that. But the thing is, you can do a bunch of toy problems.
Yep.
Cool. I've seen any number of quantum programming languages come and go. You know, you got QSKit and Python. Knock yourself out. It's still a simulation. And as I just said, you can't really simulate a quantum computer. You can do kind of ish. And is that the programming language we're going to end up using? Probably not. It's where we are today. It's in the language people and a lot of people understand and are learning. Great. I've seen people say, I can program quantum computers. And you say, fine. What useful things can you do? You know, I'm afraid it's not going to get anyone a job right now. It's the building of the quantum computer. You know, and some of the designs are just really amazingly outrageous. Things like using photons, and you wind up with a large sheet that looks like this big, thick piece of glass, and they look at it, and then you've got lasers along one side and another, and say, yeah, the entire computer is inside that sheet of glass.
So this is our kind of concept of a circuit board.
An entire computer where it's gone.
This is fundamentally, physically assembled in a very different way.
Could be grown. And it's this thing is, what does a quantum computer look like? We don't know. There's a lot of people trying a lot of things right now. It's an amazing time if you know what you're doing.
Mm.
There's more jobs than there are people to fill them. It's hard. I've studied, you know, quantum theory for more than 30 years, seriously for about 10, and then later just as a hobby on the side, and I'm still having my aha moments. And just, you know, a bit of bonus, you want to talk about Schrodinger's cat. Schrodinger's cat is a way of talking about quantum particles and entanglement. And it was still kind of hotly debated within the physics community what it's really meaning. Schrodinger said he wants to give a simple way of thinking about entangled quantum particles. He said, let's think of it this way. I got a box, there's a cat in it, and there's a vial of poison, and the box is sealed. Is a cat alive or dead? Is the poison canister broken or sealed? Can you tell by looking at the box? The answer is no. And waiting to see if it bounces around or something is not allowed in this experiment. See, open the box. The cat's going to be alive or dead. But here's the thing. The cat's entangled with the poison vial, because if you open the box and you observe the cat is alive, what's that tell you about the vial of poison? Is it broken? Is it sealed? You have to answer the question. Come on.
Well, if it's alive, it's sealed, right? If it's broken,
yeah. Poison sealed.
Yeah.
If the cat's dead?
If the cat's dead, it's broken.
Yeah. For this example, it's broken. You know, did the cat... the other one is, well, did the cat maybe starve to death?
Well, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
No, that's not allowed for this one. The point is, if the cat's dead, it's dead due to the fact the vial of poison is broken. So if you look at this, it tells you a couple of things about entangled particles. Because quantum mechanics says if you've got two entangled particles, like the cat and the vial of poison, and you observe one, you can tell what the other one is unambiguously.
Mm.
Cat's alive, poison sealed. Cat's dead, poison's broken. But you see, you've got two states for both things.
Yes.
And quantum mechanics also says if you have those two particles that are entangled and you take them an infinite distance away and you observe one, then you know what the other one's state is. Now think about that. I've taken two particles and I've got them entangled, and there's ways of doing that. And then you can take them to one of them to the other end of the universe, and you don't even have to see it. Quantum theory says if you know, measure one of them, you know what the other one is going to be. And that's one of these fundamental things that have been thought about, argued over, discussed for a very long time. We don't know why that is. At least not at a point where anyone can kind of say, yeah, I kind of think that's right. But, you know, just because you don't know why it is doesn't mean you can't exploit it in some mechanism.
So, I probably am going to leave today with more questions again than answers.
Congratulations, you've taken your first steps into quantum computing.
Yeah, which will be I think probably what would find most people listening will feel as well. If somebody wanted to learn a little bit more about this area, what would you recommend they go and...
Well, again, I've not come prepared with references, but there are a couple of books now coming up called Quantum Computing for Computer Engineers.
Okay.
Or software engineers. There's a lot of free papers. There's a really good paper if you're a physicist, which is from like 1982, where you hear two things, at least I seem to hear two things. In quantum, it's always two things. That Richard Feynman in 82 made some statements about what you'd need a quantum computer or a quantum analog computer in order to do computations around quantum mechanical systems, because classical computers, for the reason I said earlier, there's no way that you can model more than very small, simple quantum systems with a classical computer or all the classical computers on the planet. And he was getting frustrated because he was trying to actually do some serious computations on quantum mechanical systems. And it's frustrating. So he started to describe what he thought a computer capable of modeling quantum systems would be itself a quantum mechanical based computer. There's another one where I found another reference in 1981. A different researcher did some work in Illinois to try to put this on a theoretical basis. And what you can really say is kind of the early 80s, people began saying, what kind of computer do I need to make meaningful, precise calculations in quantum physics? And it's proceeded from there. If you're really interested in how classical computers are designed, you know a lot of circuit theory, you're familiar with that, you kind of get off on that, you can learn what building a quantum computer out of quantum gates and quantum operators can do, because it's kind of similar without having to dive deeply into all the math. But you really have to want to learn that, either for a job or because you really are interested in it. And most of us aren't really trying to design computers in our spare time.
So possibly then the books, the Quantum Computing for Engineers and Quantum Computing for Software Developers, are maybe the best practical starting point for people who want to understand a bit more about quantum without having to learn the physics, without having to learn how to design the, or grow the circuit board, so to speak.
But, you know, it's still going to feel a little empty because the field is just, you know, in order to have a whole bunch of people programming quantum computers, you need quantum computers. We have some that are very, you know, very few qubits. You can do some playing around. It's even arguable that, you know, we talk about Shor's algorithm. We throw Shor's algorithm around a lot. It's actually being argued that currently no one's actually implemented Shor's real algorithm. It's kind of, it's Shor-ish, Shor nearby, even, you know, on the small computers. So, you know, it's early days. There may be some fantastic things. And we get back to like modeling a real quantum system. What does that do for us? It could do some amazing things in drug discovery. It could do some amazing things in building and discovering metamaterials and how to create them. You know, materials not found in nature that has some really interesting physical quantities that might enable us to build some equally amazing things. I tend to use amazing a lot in these discussions. Don't know, but there's the potential, the possibility. It's what I find exciting about it. What I get tired about is people marketing to me how wonderful this world is when it's not here. And you know, it's great. I love marketers. They tell me about things. But it's like, you don't have the math. And by the way, people who, you know, if you're listening out there in the audience, someone says, I know quantum computing. Say, okay, describe Shor's algorithm. Come on. How does it work? And you can both be disappointed.
I'm not sure I follow.
No, I'm saying someone says they understand quantum computing, ask them to explain Shor's algorithm.
Oh, gotcha.
They're not going to know, and you're not going to know.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So apparently I'm having as much luck explaining Shor's algorithm. So that's very quantum in itself.
Yeah. Hey, Ken, look, we've taken a lot of your time today and just want to say thank you for joining us again.
I wish I could say something more definite. We've just sort of gone around and around because that's the kind of problem with having this discussion.
Well, I think that's kind of the point of having the discussion, isn't it, as well, to say, look, this thing is evolving. There isn't an answer, and there is some quite fundamental bits and pieces that are being worked out I don't know if even worked out is the right word, experimented with, learnt from. But, you know, I think it's just, again, from my perspective, I probably thought of quantum as not a linear step, but a progression from where we are today. And I think the discussion that we had last time that we've had today is actually you're starting right back again at base theory of what a computer is. And then that's building upon that, the outcomes and the possibilities are vastly different as well. But it's almost like a parallel field to classic computing, not a progression, is kind of, I guess, what I've taken.
Well, here's one way to look at it.
Mm.
If you're in the audience watching this and it's still in the 2020s and you haven't gone to university yet, think of it like this. By the time you retire, this may be a really interesting field. No, I mean, as I said, we're kind of looking around 50 years thinking that's course and speed, how we're advancing.
Yeah.
Kind of where it's going to take, which means if you're, you know, if you're 20, you might see this by the time you retire or after you retire and say, yeah, there's this thing I saw years ago and there's this guy sort of talking around it. And yeah, I guess she's kind of right.
Well, Ken, thank you again for your time today.
And you're welcome.
Thank you to those who have tuned in to listen. Of course, you can drop comments in our LinkedIn feed if you want to ask any extra questions, and we'll try to get them through to Ken. But I guess my summary would be, from what you've just said, watch the space, and in 50 years, we may be back to give you an update.
Who knows? Medical science may also perform a miracle, and we'll be here doing something other than mumbling.
Awesome. Thanks.
Fantastic. Look, thank you for having me. Appreciate having you back a second time. It's always fun to talk with you.
Awesome. Cheers, Ken. Thank you very much.
Bye, everyone.